I knew that my life was going to end one of two ways. And it was never like, oh, I'm just going to shoot dope and be a wino the rest of my life. No, no. Like, that was not accepting to me. What was going to happen in my life was either I was going to overdose in the process or I was going to get sober.
Change your actions and your thoughts will follow.
Exactly. Because I can't think myself out of the terrible situation that I've created for myself coming from the problem, which is my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to like change my behaviors and become open-minded to finally be willing just enough to realize that I can't do it, but you clearly can. Can you show me?
Right.
And it worked when I went from possessing that job that consists of knowing everything to realizing what I do know is that I don't fucking know. The pain became so great that I was no longer like,
right.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. That's all I knew is that I no longer wanted to feel how I felt. The pain was like, I'm not the alcoholic that changes when shit's unmanageable. I change when it's unfucking bearable.
So if you're hopeless and you feel that you can't change a behavior, you're like, I've tried 50 times, whether it's losing weight, whether it's finding love, whether it's getting sober, you should not stop listening to this podcast episode until the very end so that you could get some hope and probably some tools so you can make some changes in your life. But before we get there, make sure you click to subscribe, rate and review, and share this. I put it out. It's free. It's free to listen to this. So share it with your friends, share it with your family, and also message me about it on social media. But my guest today is Brandon Novak. Thank you for coming on Always Evolving.
I'm extremely honored. I'm extremely honored to be here and completely underprepared.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, it's sometimes it's really good to prepare if it's serious. It's a very, you know, important thing.
Yeah.
Well, you were preparing for your trip out here.
And what's the saying? When you want to make God laugh, tell him.
Right, that you have plans.
How your day is going to go.
Yeah, yeah. How you soon next few days.
That's me, man.
Because I had messaged you on social media. I think your story's fascinating. I think you're an interesting guy. We've never met.
Never. This is.
Yeah, this is our first.
This is getting really intimate really quick.
Yeah.
I love it.
I know. And you were coming out here because you were skateboarding. And you've been a pro skateboarder for many years, right?
Yeah. So I came out here, you know, at 42, I'm creating like a new video part, a video part that stands the test of time with the work that I've put into kind of getting to where I'm at in life. And I have a lot of rad stuff. Just got back from Barcelona filming a lot out there. And I came out here to hit a few spots and a few tricks that I had on the list. And my first day in, I 6 days cleared the calendar, flew a filmer out with me, hotel rooms, cars, you know. First day out, I pull my groin and I'm out. Mm. The most expensive one trick I've ever acquired in skateboarding. So
meanwhile, you're looking at the rates of hotels.
Literally.
Right? And now you're like, ah, oh, shit, I just booked someone for a week.
Literally.
Paid for everything.
I'm not kidding you. I've watched that, because I showed you the trick that I got at the first spot where I pulled my groin, and I've watched that trick like 8 times a day to feel better about the position that I'm in.
Because you nailed it.
I'm like, okay, hopefully this will justify.
So you've been part of the crew that was in some of the Jackass movies. Would you say you were a skateboarding prodigy growing up?
I'll answer that in a second, but I want to bring it back before I forget. Yeah. I loved how you started this out. If you're interested in changing your beliefs, then watch this in its entirety. And I'm a big fan, right? Because what the problem is our behaviors, our thinking, and our attitude, right? It really has, the catalyst that got me to the 12-step program that allowed me to have this psychic change, meaning I no longer think how I thought, was learning that my behaviors were the problem,
right?
So what I learned is, it is impossible for me to use the very same brain that landed me into my 13th inpatient treatment center to outthink myself out of the position that I had created for myself. So I'm a big believer in if you change your behaviors, your beliefs will soon follow. Mm. Right. So I just had to bring that back to what you said. I love
that. Change your actions and your thoughts will follow.
Exactly. Because I can't think myself out of the terrible situation that I've created for myself coming from the problem, which is my thinking. Mm-hmm. So I had to like change my behaviors and become open-minded to finally be willing just enough to realize that I can't do it, but you clearly can. Can you show me?
Right.
And it worked when I went from possessing that job that consists of knowing everything to realizing what I do know is that I don't fucking know.
But this was a something that you learned later in life.
Oh, so yeah.
Talk to me about your childhood.
Yeah. If you would have asked me at 30, 60, 90 days sober what my childhood looked like, I would have told you with a straight face and a heart full of conviction that it was the most debilitating childhood that any child should ever have to endure, and I wouldn't wish it upon my worst enemy. Get the fuck out of here, right? Now with coming up on 7 years sober and finally having done like the internal work that was required in order to achieve the external results that I've always desired, what I can tell you with a heart full of conviction is that I came from a really good home with loving family members that did the best that they could with what they had. Mm. And what that means is my mother got her very first job at the age of 15, drawing blood for $5 a pop, a phlebotomist, if you will, at Mercy Hospital, and literally worked her way up the ladder to become a nuclear physicist on the board of that hospital. My father never held a job a day in his life. He taught me one thing, if and when I go to prison, how to conduct himself. He acquired the liking of crack cocaine and his body shut down and he died as a direct result of his disease.
What age were you?
My timeline's really foggy because I've basically been disconnected from reality from like 15 toasty. To is an understatement. That's being generous. From 16, end of 16, 17, full blown heroin addict till 38 when I checked into my 13th, God willing, last treatment center. I was completely disconnected from reality. The way I kind of look at timelines is I have this documentary coming out about my life and they said, where were you in 1999 winter, December-ish? And I'm like, I know exactly where I was. 1999 was the year that Y2K was about to happen. 2000, the whole world was in a frenzy that everything was going to shut down because the computers wouldn't be able to equate.
Right.
So me and two of my running buddies were homeless in East Baltimore. And we had crowbars and pillowcases and we were going to rob and loot once the power went out and the world shut down at midnight. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. Therefore, January 1st, I checked myself into a detox, 2000. That's how my mind thinks of where I was at that time. Right, you know what I mean? It's not
I'm with you. It kind of, it's hard to remember much when you're getting high all the time. It's a giant fog.
Yeah.
And I think the same applies too for any self-destructive behavior in general. You just, when you're numb, if you numb yourself out enough, you lose track and sense of everything.
Yeah.
Because you're just numb and you're just, you know, the same goes with someone who's highly clinically depressed, you know, can't leave the house. They have no track of time. You know, it's also why they may go a week without showering.
Sure.
They just literally are just in this routine that they just can't get out of.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's you know.
Trying to get him out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
But you had to have been amazing at skateboarding, because all the videos I was watching and interviews with you talked about how great of a skateboarder you were at a young age.
So that's the thing, right? My mother's a nuclear physicist. My father dies of addiction. My brother turns out to be an attorney in the White House, practicing pensions and benefits. So I'm not a fool by any means, and I come from better. I know better. But the complexity and severity of my disease, which is defined as alcoholism, states that the disease of addiction doesn't discriminate from the White House or the outhouse. The results are all the same. And for me, at the age of 17, I was blessed with the ability for someone to put a skateboard in my hand. I think we all have these God-given talents.
So you didn't skate until 17?
No, seven.
Oh, seven.
I was right? Just... Like, I think you could be the best ping pong player in the world, but God might not see fit to allow a paddle to find your hand.
Right.
You know, like someone literally placed a skateboard in my hand at 7 years old.
Yeah.
And that night when my mother put me to bed, she said, "What would you like me to do with your skateboard?" And I remember it like I'm touching this chair. I said, "I want it in bed with me." She said, "Why?" I said, "Because if I die, I want it to go with me." Like the moment that board touched my hand, I knew I was going to be a skateboarder for the rest of my life. There was no reason for like a plan B, a trait, or an option, which oddly enough, that skill set kind of transcended into my drinking and drugging career that maybe you can relate to, despite any and all adverse consequences that come my way. I did what I had to do to get what I wanted to get.
Right.
Right. So then at the age of 15, I'm like the first skateboarder to be endorsed by Gatorade. They're flying me to Chicago to the Quaker Oats building where they make Gatorade at the time. And they put me on this treadmill, and Michael Jordan is on a treadmill next to me, and they strap these EKGs to our chest and
wow,
give us each Gatorade to see the effects that it has on different sports players. You know, so literally
God gave you the gift where you had an amazing balance. Everything just kind of came naturally on a skateboard.
Yeah, like football,
let me
don't
ask
bother.
You, I remember in high school, I was friends with all the different cliques and groups of people, but I always remember the ones that skated, even in junior high. And I was friends with some of these guys. I wasn't deep in that world because I couldn't even rollerblade. You know, I couldn't pog. I don't know if you remember pogs. I couldn't pog.
You're dating yourself at this point, man.
What's that?
You're dating yourself at this point.
I played basketball. Yeah. My whole family's tall. I'm the shortest male.
Oh, wow.
So we didn't skate or surf. But why does that... I always think this is interesting. Same thing with hip-hop. Hip-hop, they'll sing so much about Percocet and drugs, and it's a part of the thing, right? It's part of the art that they say. With skating, I don't know why growing up, I had this impression that skateboarders were black sheep, kind of outcast vibes that would get angry quickly. This is a total generalization. But they would get angry quickly, and you didn't want to touch the cactus.
Yeah. You're not wrong. Let's just say you're not wrong. I think for me and the rest of my people, which are skaters, we were kind of, so here's the deal, right? Growing up in high school, I was not the cool kid. I was not the sociably accepted kid whose mailbox overflowed with invites to the keg party on Friday nights.
Right.
Right. I was the kid doing kickflips in the parking lot, and like the varsity sports guys from the football team would throw my board on the roof, right? True story. And then you fast forward to I start ending up in these magazines, Thrasher and Trans World. And I'll never forget it. Spanish class, ninth grade. I love this chick, Natasha, smoke show, right? She wants no part of me. I get an ad in Trans World Skateboarding Magazine. I bring the magazine in and I just leave it on the desk, her desk, ironically. And I'm watching.
What a coincidence.
I'm like, so coincidental. And I'm watching during class and she starts flipping through. And all of a sudden she puts two and two together and points at me. And literally by the end of that day, I was invited to like every one of those parties. And Natasha was my girlfriend. You know what I mean? So that quick, but prior to that, we weren't the cool kids and we like didn't have it easy if you're looking at it from that perspective
why is that with skateboard, and has that changed much, do you think?
Well, I think now it absolutely has. It's totally become not only accepting and acceptable, but promoted widely because it was just in the Olympics. Right. So remember the sticker, skateboarding is a crime?
Right.
To now, skateboarding is in the Olympics.
Yeah, I remember the skateboarder. I grew up in Nelly Gale Ranch, and I want to say in Laguna Hills. And I remember it was like, they shouldn't allow skateboarders in this parking lot. I guess skateboarders would take over parking lots, right?
You're starting the reason why lots. We were so pissed off.
No, it wasn't me.
I'm just kidding.
But yeah, the mothers.
Yeah, like, sure. Why,
because skateboarders would take over parking lots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And drink and party. And why do you think it's because there's risk involved with skateboarding that also kind of breeds behaviors that are more adrenaline focused or getting high?
I can't give a generalized statement as to why that's so, but what I can do is give you my experience with my world that brought me into recovery ultimately. Is for me in the skateboarding world, there was really little to no accountability, right? Like I didn't have, my boss consisted of a team captain in Santa Barbara, California for Pal Peralta while I'm living in Baltimore, Maryland. So I'm like a 13, 14 year old kid who's going to the payphone, shoveling like $5 worth of quarters in to make a collect call to tell Todd about a trick I've learned this week, or a new video part that I'm filming, or a product that I need, right? Like I'm not showing up to a 9 to 5 clocking in where a boss and coworkers can see my behaviors. Right. No one's monitoring or keeping into account my behaviors and when they're shifting, no matter which way that is. And being the young kid that I was, but very gifted and talented, right, being blessed with a skateboard, older people took me in. I skated with older guys, not kids of my age. I didn't have to come in when the street lights came on. We traveled around and they accepted me. And therefore, everything that I've learned in my life is retrospect. My life is live forward and learn backwards. So at the time, I could not see this. I was incapable of seeing the situation. Today, I can see it as clear as day. It is that by the time I had drifted too far out to sea and wasn't very like redeemable or salvageable, people just thought that there was a method to my madness because of the prior success to that point. You know what I mean? So like, he's cool. He must know what he's doing. Right. He's at 15, or 14, he's sponsored by Gatorade. At 15, he's, you know, designing his prototype pro shape for Pal Peralta.
Yeah, it's like, I think of it as musical artists I've worked with that are more in the indie space. They'll sometimes when they're doing something or they're addicted or what have you, they'll say, well, they're very tortured. You know, they're a tortured soul. I'll be like, no, they're a drug addict.
Yeah, I would say it's just a fancy word for
they're
addiction.
They're using this mirage.
Absolutely.
You know, the brilliance comes from this. No, they just want to get high, or they're just being entitled.
Sure, you know, I couldn't agree more. But, you know, at that point in time, the disconnection from reality that we're in, that completely makes sense because the abnormal is the normal. So it's like, no, fuck you for not seeing that I'm a tortured soul.
Right.
Today, now, coming up on 7 years sober, again, having done the work, it's so clear for me to see that you know, the mirage, the tortured soul, the tortured artist that produced these great outcomes is simply just a justification of fancy words for I'm an addict or an alcoholic.
Right. Yeah. You were addicted to heroin for how many years?
Yeah, from like 17 to 38.
Your first rehab was when?
At the beautiful, ripe young age of 17.
So right after you started.
Yeah.
Because you loved it so much. And I'm guessing there was a consequence or someone intervened?
Well, there wasn't a consequence. It was more like, I'm going to go to this treatment center to prove a point why I'm A, not my father, because I couldn't stand him at the time, right?
Because do you remember which one?
Which father?
No, which rehab?
Yeah, the name of it, no.
No.
Well, I do, Mountain Manor in Baltimore. Okay. It was a juvenile facility. I was 17 years old and I was taken to it. And I went there simply to prove a point that this was an overreaction at best. You just caught me at a bad time.
Your mom or?
It was my, she offered it. But now keep in mind, 2 months prior to this offer from my mother and my girlfriend, I was given the same opportunity from Pal Peralta, which was my dream childhood, like end all be all. They said if I went to treatment, I could, you know, save my life and continue to skate for the team, which is all I ever wanted.
Pal Peralta,
Tony Hawk, Bones Brigade.
The crew of the legends.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there. I was in that
crew.
Yeah. And what I didn't know then that I know now is the severity of my disease that I've been diagnosed with, titled alcoholism or addiction. It did not allow me to have the privilege to sit things out because they weren't safe for my life. Right. So when that ultimatum was given to me at 17, never had been in treatment, no interactions or repercussions from my addiction, the disconnection from reality was so insane and so far already that I was completely incapable of seeing it, that I, for the first time in my life, they attempted to stand between me and my drug. And without a breath of fresh air in my lungs, I said, I quit. I'm done. You know, and then I celebrated that night by continuing to get as high as possibly could be.
Right.
So then cut to 3 months later, my mother and my girlfriend come to me with the very same offer. And the realistic answer that you would have to what I'm about to say is, oh, he would never go. Why would he go if he just turned it down from them? But again, the disconnection from reality, I'm like, you know what? That's a great idea. I'm already like the psychic, the mind is just insane. The disease is so far on me. And I went to prove, A, I'm not my father. B, I can use successfully. This is just an overreaction at best. You caught me at a bad time, on a bad way, in a bad day. And tomorrow's going to be different. And I meant that. But unfortunately, I'd wake up tomorrow to repeat yesterday's actions, and I'd be stuck in Groundhog's Day for 24 years. But I was incapable of seeing that. So I went in there focusing only on the differences, not the similarities.
And how many times did you do that?
Well, I'm the kind of guy that I'm a firm believer in a hard head makes for a soft ass. And I absolutely have the softest ass in this room.
A hard head makes for a soft ass. Tony, what does that mean?
When you I don't know.
A hard head makes for a soft ass.
A hard head makes for a soft ass. I guess that means I have a hard head, Mike. I don't know.
So you're also saying you have a very soft ass, Tony. Is that
yeah,
what
that is? Exactly,
okay.
Hell yeah. But that's good. But do you think, and this is just me asking, did the drugs like elevate like your skateboarding, like your skills? Like,
oh,
did
it
you
did
feel
the
like
exact opposite?
It did.
Yeah. I started to neglect my responsibilities.
Did you believe at any time that it was helping? Was there a period where you're like, oh,
I knew. Yeah. I let's put it this way. I was not like the go-getter on heroin. You know, I wasn't like
right.
getting high, like, oh, I'm going to go film this clip and do, I
you
was
would
like,
do a weak sister kickflip. It would be a sad, tired kickflip.
Yeah. Weak
right?
sister. Yeah.
Right. With the lights are, it's almost, he would go when it's kind of getting dark out. So it's not even good lighting really. And you're wearing clothes that probably are not washed.
Oh, that's, well, at that point in time in my life, I was still pretty put together.
You were?
Yeah. At that this
how
very
many
early stage.
In did you stop being put together?
I'd say, let's see, probably around number eight. Around number eight, you know, and that's when, again, the repercussions.
Was part of it because you just wanted to clean your system at a certain point? You were like, all right, I'm sick of being addicted to heroin. I have these feelings. I don't want to keep, like, I just want to detox myself. Was some of it spin drying, or was it really you intentionally were trying to prove you weren't your dad several times?
You know, what I've learned is that looking back is and I say this to people, none of those attempts do I categorize as failures.
Right.
I believe everyone was a success in its own right because these seeds were planted. Right along the way. And I did the worst thing I could
say it one more time because I think it's awesome.
None of these attempts were failures because every time that I attempted to get sober, these seeds were planted. That, you know, ignorance is bliss. When you don't know, you're not to be held accountable. But when you know, you know. And try shooting a bag of dope when it's cut with NA. Or drinking a glass of wine when it's cut with AA.
Right.
It doesn't quite sit so right because I'm accountable for my actions because ignorance is no longer bliss. Because I did the worst thing I could have ever done for my career of addiction or alcoholism. I sat through a 12-step meeting or successfully or unsuccessfully completed a treatment center. But nonetheless, I sat there and some things were acquired, you know.
Right.
And so what happened was, you know, after all these attempts, finally the pain became great enough that all these seeds that were planted along the way completely just like blossomed and it all kind of connected, the sky parted, and I walked across water. It's insane. But along the way, it was different reasons for each time. And that's the complexity of alcoholism and addiction, right? Like a lot of times I meant and believed what I was doing and I'm going to remain sober and I'm never going to do this again. And I'm a changed individual. Sometimes I did it because the parole officer was going to violate me and I was going to go back to prison.
You got arrested what, 6 times?
Yeah. Fuck. I've lost count.
Okay.
Yeah. I was like a nuisance to the system, right? I've never committed a violent crime. I was like a possession with intent, theft under like stealing clothes, just annoying to police, to courts, right, to probate. I was just annoying. It was like a gnat that wouldn't go away. So I never really did any real time except for the one time I forged a prescription and that's, they don't take that too lightly. And that's a felony. And I got caught for that while I was filming Jackass, actually.
Wow.
That's a whole other story. So it just depended on the particular trip to said treatment center of what my reality looked like then, what the circumstances were, you know?
Because I think a lot of people, after trying to stop something as self-destructive as heroin, after... And people do this with their behaviors, even with diets, or they do it with, they try a business and it fails. So they never do it again. I tried it. And, you know, it's kind of this black and white period of time where somehow it's going to inform everything.
Sure.
It sounds like you kept coming back, kept attempting, regardless of the dysfunction in it. There was a part of you that kept leading you to do that.
I love exactly how you just worded what you said. And I don't even think I know you don't realize what you said, but if you think about it, how I kept coming back, I kept attempting. I attribute a lot of my sobriety and recovery as a direct result of my skateboarding, right? Skateboarding weeds out the quitters. Mm. And I will skate a ramp, a parking lot, a curb, steps, a rail for days on end trying one trick. And quitting is not an option. Right. Like, and I just try and try and try until that one makes. So I really, you know, attribute a lot of my sobriety. There's a lot of moving parts to it, but a lot of it from that skateboard that I was blessed with at 7 years old. Skateboarding weeds out the quitters. And so therefore, like, I knew that my life was going to end one of two ways. And it was never like, oh, I'm just going to shoot dope and be a wino the rest of my life. No, no. Like, that was not accepting to me. What was going to happen in my life was either I was going to overdose in the process or I was going to get sober. Mm. And I remember like being on the set of Viva La Bam, filming the Viva La Bam stuff. And afterwards we'd go out to the party and go to the bar and just get loaded. And I'd tell Bam, who I live with, I'd be like, yo, I'll meet you at the pub. Mm. He's like, where are you going? And I'm like, I'm going to go to a meeting. He's like, what the fuck? You're going to go to an AA meeting and then you're going to meet us at the bar after. And I'm like, yeah. Because the reality is I knew that my life was going to end one of two ways. And then once I get into the program and learn about the steps and the traditions, the third tradition is the only desire for membership is the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. You know, and I had that the whole time. So like,
yeah. And I think that, so what you're saying is through all these experiences, because culture does, and even in the rooms at times, there is this very black and white, your length of time is celebrated. It's kind of similar, even though I don't necessarily agree that we have to applaud marriages that have lasted so long, or sobriety. I mean, it's one day at a time. We have this moment we have today. It's amazing. It's admirable as we, you know, have over 19 years sober, but it's kind of like, once you start the process, you're feeding your soul with new information, new tools, new wisdom. And you're the type of guy that didn't shut down and revert back to being just 17 years old. It's interesting because some people that I've worked with, they'll go off. There's you know, when you talk about still going to an AA meeting or an NA meeting and still having a desire and keep on trying, it's kind of like skateboarding. That's the brilliance of what you have, because you never really lost faith.
Yes.
Even as bad as it got, even as you were doing things that were horrible and you look back and you're like, oh God, that was really dysfunctional. You still kept coming back and you still kept showing up. And do you think, is there a moment, or do you think it's a collection of tools that have led to you now accumulating several years?
People ask that. They're like, well, what was the difference? Why treatment center number 13? And the reality is that question is completely valid. Like, to be honest,
you like that number. I've become a fan of that number.
Treatment center number 13 didn't teach me anything that 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1 missed. They did not. And I didn't know what was going to be different, if anything was going to be different. What I can say for certain, without a shadow of doubt, is that finally, what I've learned today, I didn't know it at the time, but May 25th, 2015, I was divinely inconvenienced, faith, right? Divinely inconvenienced in just such a manner that the God of my understanding showed up and created just a big enough gap between me and the last bag of heroin that I shot into my arm that allowed me to have that moment of clarity to see what my life really looked like was. And I was no longer accepting of it. I was no longer accepting of it. And after having tried to get sober, 12 inpatient treatment centers, lost count of outpatients and detoxes, all those seeds that were planted, a lot of things took place in a very short period of time. Number one, maturity, right? 38 years old, no longer accepting of my position that I place myself in. I, Brandon Novak, do that. It was no longer like the parole officer, both ex-fiancés, you know, the judge, the mother. No, like I did this to myself. So right away I took accountability for my actions unbeknownst to me. It just all made sense. The second thing was
35
like-
35 or
38?
38. So 38, but you're 42, but you have-
No. So my age thing is a very strange thing. I don't know if I was born in 77 or 78. My mother does not recall. I came from a really crazy household. My birth certificate says one thing. My ID says another. It's insane. So I was born in 77. If you do the math, help me out here. I like to stick to 41 because it's a good number and it doesn't make me feel old. I'm sure I'm later.
Yeah, I'm 79. I'm 42.
Okay. I was born 12/10/77 is my birthday.
Yeah, so you're 44.
Yeah,
that's a rough number.
Let's go back to 41, all right? So true, man.
Yeah, when you came in, he's like, you know, I'm 42 years old. And yeah, even before we started the podcast, he told me he was 42. I was like, yeah, I'm 42 too. He's like, right on.
Trauma bond.
You're 42.
Fucking 38. Yeah. So the first thing that happened was I was no longer accepting of the circumstances I placed myself in. And as addicts or alcoholics, you know, the thing that we do least is accept responsibility for our actions.
Right.
Did that. Second thing was I could no longer deny the severity of my disease that I accepted the diagnosis of, right? Because my very best thinking places me here over and over and over. And I see that it works for people like you because you have 19 years sober. Like I see that, right? So maybe I am the problem and the drug is merely the catalyst that got me to a position to finally ask for help and get better. And it has nothing to do with the drug. It's just the behaviors, the thinking, the attitude. And I just kind of got out of my way and I was demoralized in just such a fashion where I was beaten into that state of reasonableness. The pain became so great that I was no longer like,
afraid.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. That's all I knew is that I no longer wanted to feel how I felt. The pain was like, I'm not the alcoholic that changes when shit's unmanageable. I change when it's unfucking bearable.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
So what, describe for me what unbearable, fucking unbearable means.
Oh, okay.
Like, what are the thoughts? What is this?
I'm going to give you a mental picture.
Yeah, give it.
And if there was an artist here, they could draw it. 38, I believe, 38 years old, walking into my 13th treatment center, despite like being a successful individual that had did some things in life that people would accredit to success, happiness, potentially even dream of. The reality of what my disease really looks like is this. May 24th, 2015, I come to in Mercy Hospital after having been on life support for 7 days, the very same hospital my mother's a nuclear physicist on the board of. I rip the tubes out of every hole in my body. You can use your imagination. I put my clothes on and I run into West Baltimore to cop a little bit more heroin. And at this time I'm a homeless drug addict, right? So I have these like at once point in time, nice pair of slacks with no underwear on underneath. Cause I'm like, I don't do that. And these cigarette hole burns in my pants. I have this button up shirt on and I have these Brooks Brothers shoes with one shoestring. I had lost the other shoestring along the way. And when I went to cop from the boys saw fit to rob me as opposed to serve me. And when they robbed me, they ripped my front and my back pockets completely out. Now my dick and my ass are completely exposed. They ripped my shirt open and the only button that stays buttoned is this very top button. And I have these shoes on with one shoestring. I'm now roaming the streets of West Baltimore looking like a gay East LA cholo gangbanger. Everything that I own in my life consists of 8 scarves, 2 jackets, 3 socks, 1 stick of deodorant that fits into that bag that doubles as my pillow, a needle, a spoon, and a restraining order. That's all I own at 38 years old. My very best.
Restraining order.
Yeah, my mother had served me a restraining order to physically be removed from her home because I was like literally killing her on a layaway plan. By her having to watch me get high every day, all day, right? Like my mother's everything to me. I've never like physically done anything to her mentally. Like I was just fucking bashing her in the head with a brick over and over. You know what I mean?
Emotionally.
Like, yeah, emotionally, just like,
yeah.
And I would have done the same if the role was reversed. Like I completely get it. My very best has me standing on the corner of Eastern Avenue and Patterson Park, prostituting my body just to secure enough finances to acquire another bag. And
men, women,
anybody,
anyone who you don't care.
Yeah, like I lost the right to have a say so in my life with my disease that I possess, and I just couldn't deny that, like how bad things had got. And here's another big part in that play: every time, without fail. Heroin, wine, cocaine, pills, it did its job. When I called, it showed up. I injected it, I swallowed it, I sniffed it, I snorted it. A delusional effect was produced without fail that would allow me to escape the reality that I had created for myself. Mm-hmm. Meaning that, like, not only is like standing on the corner prostituting my body for heroin, like, not bad. It's almost desirable, right? Like, it creates this delusional narrative for in sure. my mind that allow me to justify the horrible behaviors.
No, I did a few times back. I get it.
So, yeah. So, right?
I wasn't working the corner.
Yeah.
That would have been a whole other level. I think I was too vain to work a corner, but I had a different game plan.
Well, I was
but
too.
But you got beaten into such desperation, yes, and loss of control. You had no fucking choice. To survive.
Exactly. So
you're
when I go
survival.
Literally, when I go speak at these programs and stuff, I'm a motivational speaker and I have to share, because if they're anything like me, they'll sit in the back and they'll deflect or justify their story compared to mine, because I was never that guy, nor would I ever be. And I have to remind them that my story was not my story either in the beginning. Mm. Because I was too vain to work the corners too, until I wasn't too
vain. Until you weren't too
vain,
right?
Like,
I get it.
Like, it's just the layers.
So what happens? So you have a button. I kind of imagine it's, I don't know why there was a cartoon called Darkwing Duck back in the day.
I remember that. Yeah.
I just picture you had like a little cape.
Yeah. That's
but I'm picturing
very similar.
You like in your crotch is open. Your ass is open. You got robbed of your pocket. Why did they steal your pockets?
Well, they ripped my pockets out
as they were robbing.
Just
you.
Like,
gotcha.
My front and my pocket. So, and I had no underwear on. So it just ironically ripped out like this and then my back. So I had crotchless pants.
So you're standing outside?
Oh, yeah. Roaming the streets of like the projects in Baltimore City with completely exposed, literally, my shirt with only this button that remained buttoned and shoes with one shoestring on. and everything that I own. And I still have this bag in my house. When I get home, I'm going to take a picture of it and send it to you. It's right in my foyer of my home.
The same bag.
I'm a firm believer that I keep my past married to my present, because the moment I forget the pain that brought me through the doors that offered me salvation, I'll forget. Because I have this selective memory when it plays in. And the longer I stay sober, the more in jeopardy I could be if I don't remain proactive in my sobriety. Mm-hmm. Right? But here's the deal. It's really pretty simple today because I've done the work.
But tell me what happens then in that moment. So,
fuck, a lot happened.
So because you're telling me this is the mindset, this is the demoralizing moment.
Yeah. So here, okay, so then I show up, I have to see my parole officer in that outfit. They take me to see the parole officer. He grants me one more shot of mercy, clemency, if you will, and sends me back to the same facility I have been to four previous attempts out of 13 overall. And what it would look like is usually I would sit in the same chair with the same intake coordinator, and she would say to me, okay, Mr. Novak, your insurance will cover you for 90 days. My rebuttal to that without fail would be 90 days in theory is great, but in reality, I'm more of like a 45 day kind of fella, right? I got this woman to see, this job to fulfill, this state to go to.
Yeah.
May 25th, 2015, the terms of my contract had forever changed. I'm sitting in the same chair with the same woman. She gives me the same offer without fail. But on this day, the only difference is I can't come back with a counteroffer, because if I say no, it entails an explanation. For the first time in my life, I was beaten speechless by my disease. I swear to God, I couldn't put like two words together. I was just... like done. I was beaten into submission. And she gently laughed and she said, sweetheart, you're in no condition to do your intake. Get up to detox. I'll see you in 4 days. I take my gay East LA cholo gangbanger look and my 8 scarves, 2 jackets, 3 socks, stick of deodorant fits into my bag, doubles as my pillow, needle, spoon, restraining order, and I walk up to the detox. I'm met by a 19-year-old tech that goes by the name of Brian. And Brian's smiling from ear to ear. And he said, Mr. Novak, you're back. I said, aren't you a fucking genius? You don't skip a beat, do you, boy? Like, he said, Mr. Novak, I regret to inform you, your clothes are not rehab oriented. You need some underwear. You need some sweatpants. You need some slides. And I heard you nut jobs always telling me a grateful addict will never use again. A grateful alcoholic will never. That sounded great, but it didn't really apply. But on this day, as smiling, happy-go-lucky, sober 19-year-old tech rehab working Brian smiles from ear to ear, and I'm the least confrontational you could have ever met, like from things that I experienced
broken
as a child, father, right. Yeah. But I've never wanted to knock someone's head off more in my life, because it had been so long since I smiled or found optimism in anything that I took it really personal when you did it in my company, you know? And he said, it's okay, Mr. Novak, come downstairs to the basement. We're going to go to the donations room and we're going to see if we can find you some used underwear. And I'm praying to God that he finds me used underwear. Now, keep in mind, this is a Catholic Charities rehab that cost me $2 to get into. We walk downstairs to the basement. The electricity doesn't work. The walls are kind of sweating. There's these boxes, cardboard boxes that are coming apart at the seam because they're just like mildewy.
Yeah.
And he gives me his phone and I'm holding his phone and he's thumbing through looking for a pair of second, third, fourth, fifth hand pair of used underwear. I'm praying to God that he finds them. At that moment, if you would have opened up the English dictionary and added the word less to every word in that book, that's how I felt about my life at that moment. Unbeknownst to me, my life was about to forever change. He doesn't find me the used underwear, but what he finds me is a pair of size 40 women's sweatpants with no drawstring, a woman's tank top, and a pair of size 13 Jesus sandals. I'm not a woman and I do not wear a size 13. But what happened at that very moment, I went, right? Because when I put my hand up and I say I'm an alcoholic, all that means is that I'm defiant by nature. I hate authority and I'll never conform because I possess this job that places me in a lot of positions I don't like to be in. And it allows me to feel a lot of feelings I don't like to feel. And that job consists of knowing everything. Mm. So thank you, Mr. 19 years, for suggesting to me what I should do to save my life. But I'm going to suggest why you should fuck off.
Mm-hmm.
Standing in the basement of that Catholic Charities rehab as this kid hands me women's clothes and shoes that do not fit. I came to the realization that, you know what I do know is that I don't know. And my very best thinking, despite movies, the author who's written an autobiography, addiction memoir about my life, insanely successful skater, is now and so when he hands me these women's clothes and shoes and outfit, I was overcome with a sense of willingness unlike anything a human has ever produced. And now what I understand, to be clear, is having remained sober for a long enough period of time, having done the work, it's very easy for me to look back and recognize the synchronicity in life's events that have led me literally right here, right now, that proved to me that the God of my understanding has been doing so much more for me, so much bigger than I could ever conceive. Mm. When I was handed those clothes that were meant for a woman and shoes didn't fit, I was overcome with that sense of willingness. And what I didn't know then that I know now is that I was met directly face to face by the God of my understanding as a direct result of that gift of desperation. Mm. The pain had become great enough that unbeknownst to me, it became like my purpose. I just like wanted to not feel how I felt anymore. Went upstairs, got a shower, got that Baltimore City smell off me. Never so excited to put women's clothing on in my life. Right. And I success. That's kind of like where I can look back and recognize that these miracles were taking place. Now I can see that they were happening way before. But on that day, those were the series of events that allowed me to be like, whoa, something's different.
Right. And in a lot of ways, because you've now, you know, you opened a facility, you opened up another sober living facility, recovery living. Yeah. And that all, the gift of you being able to offer that to other people is the direct result of the struggle that you went through. And the story that you went through and the pain that you went through has allowed you now to be a light in other people's lives. Right.
Literally. You know, the things that they told me in treatment, I still stick to very closely. And what they told me was like, if you change your perception, you can change your world. Hmm. And that one day your defects can become your assets. The very same reason someone with 19 years sober, insanely successful in the recovery community will reach out to you and say, hey, will you come on my podcast and deliver a message of promise, hope, and freedom, one that doesn't consist of a drink or a drug, in a form of, which I do, attraction rather than promotion.
Right.
Right. I try to give my story in such a manner and use the platform that I've built prior to sobriety in a way that it's so desirable, attractive, and appealing, so much so that you like want to fuck it. If I can get you to that point where you want what I have so bad, right, that it becomes your idea and you say at the end of my story, if he can do it, there's no reason why I can't. If I can get you to that point off of my story, then my job is done here, but it has to become your idea.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
my
really
defects
does.
Have become my assets.
Yeah.
You know, unbeknownst to me, I was incapable of seeing the blessings that were taking place at that moment. But what I did know is that my way no longer worked. I couldn't deny that. And now I'm here with you.
Now you're here and now we're sitting and...
Yeah.
What would you recommend to someone 17, never has done drugs, and his friends are pushing it on him and he wants to try it? What would you recommend to that kid?
If I was talking to any 17-year-old and they asked the question of if I thought it was a good idea for them to take part in some form of activity with a substance that will allow them to escape their reality, my question to them would be, what's lacking in your life that you think you need to have a substance provide a better life for you? Like, where are we falling short there? Right? Like, let's get to the why of the matter, not the physical act of what's being proposed. Right? I think, because what I've learned in my life, if I had to uncover my problem in order to discover it, if there were ever any hopes for me to recover from it. You know, so I get all fucking deep and spiritual with my deal, but like it's a much deeper thread than usually the drink or the drug is just the byproduct of the actual root of the problem. You know, so I'm a big believer of like, let's dissect this a little bit. Like, what's lacking in your area?
Yeah.
Right. And usually if I take the time, which is fucking tough, you know, the longer I'm sober, the more that's asked of me, the more responsibilities I have, I can get caught up in the things of life and forget that the importance of time and giving it to people when it's needed, especially in the world that I work in. You know, I kind of just go. And sometimes I neglect people of the attention they deserve, you know?
I like that.
That's
I guess you can say the same question applies to you too, Mike. What would you recommend to someone?
Why are your eyes so glazed?
I don't know, because I'm very touched by everything that he's talking about. I feel like I was almost there with you, like just like right next to you when he was talking about his past.
Yeah, once his crotch and ass went away, I kind of disappeared from the scene. He just went there. No, I just kind of watched from the rooftop across the street. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what that is. But you were right there with him.
I was right there.
Yeah.
When he described this,
the walls were sweating. Yeah, I was fucking poetic over here. I was like, that was the best description basement walls that I've ever heard.
Yeah. I was going to use moist, but that word, people tend to have pride. It's not desirable. So,
yeah, the moist is a weird word.
It's like a turn off. So it's a whole attractive, but it's a sleight of hand card game here.
You described it perfectly.
Yeah, you did.
Described it perfectly. But Mike, what would you recommend to someone, a young
Get
kid?
Get your head out of my crotch and ass his pants.
Yeah, sorry.
What would you recommend to a kid? Never touch drugs. Like, think about looking back whenever you were at the age where you first picked up, you know, your first drug or you ever tried it. What would you recommend to someone?
If someone's an addict and they're an addict, there's really not much you can do to steer them, because they're just going to figure it out even if they're in Alaska. But I do think what we're lacking in culture now, I don't know whether or not people would partake in it, but some would, is in school to teach about how to deal with anxiety, how to cope, regardless if someone thinks they're too cool to take the class or not. Some seeds would get planted, which at the end of the day would give us some tools to navigate life a little bit, because there's some people that their coping skills or where they learn coping in their house, whether they're an addict or not an addict, they literally don't know how to cope. They don't know how to believe in themselves. They don't know how to pick themselves back up again. They haven't learned. They didn't have a skateboarding experience where they were brilliant in one area. They've always thought maybe they sucked at everything. And I just wish schools would focus more on that than algebra.
I couldn't agree more.
Or more on that than...
I couldn't agree.
So many classes, or even PE. physical education. You're just like, why don't we teach people how the most important thing, which is how to treat yourself and how to cope.
Yeah.
And it's self-love. Just so odd that it's not a thing.
And I think if we got to him at that age and stage of the game, you wouldn't get me at my age and stage. You know what I mean? Yeah. I would have been, you know, salvageable or redeemable.
Yeah, or at least had
prevention.
Or maybe went a route, because you can also go a route where you can get really get high off of meditation and spiritual experiences. And that also helps a lot of people if they end up in that route, but that route isn't very accessible at a young age. It's almost like you hear of this island of
like
people,
a third world
right. But I think that's where, in my opinion, that's what's like lacking in this world is just, because you can't help what family you grow up in. Mm-hmm. You know, you just kind of dealt that family, and you can have amazing parents or not amazing parents. And if you have no other, you know, I think there's this idea that somehow people will just really want to be mentored by a teacher. I mean, maybe. I never really had that. I can't even remember my teacher's names.
Yeah.
You know, no disrespect. My sister's a teacher. I love her. But it's like what we say in the rooms. I didn't want what I had, but I didn't want what they had.
Mm. Yeah.
But that's only because I wasn't offered anything to have besides algebra.
Easy decision for you to make.
Yeah. It's like, look at the options. What is this? Right?
No, it's so spot on. It really is. But that's the thing in this world that we're in of harm reduction or prevention, there's no margin for error, yet it's impossible to do perfect.
Yeah, it's impossible.
So if we had the answer, we could bottle that thing up and sell it and be a billionaire a billion times over.
Yeah.
Now it's just like, I'm a big fan of trying and doing something.
You know, today, two guys that I won't say where I went because then I'll give away their, but it's you know, just workers. They're people. I went by a business because I had an errand to run. Mm-hmm. Both of them, one had a year off. These two guys basically are addicted to weed. Mm-hmm. And they're telling me they're the most miserable they've ever been in their life. They're angry. They're confused. They're smoking every hour. They can't stop doing it. And it's, and I don't give a fuck what people can do what they want to do in their life. But there's this idea that with addiction that even, okay, I'm not like Brandon. I didn't do heroin. That somehow your misery, that people are equally suffering. And I just think that, you know, even if someone's listening to this and they're suffering with weed addiction,
totally,
it's just interesting. I'm coming across a lot of guys and it's specifically men.
Huh? Well, in California, which kind of makes a lot of sense with the weed world out here.
Yeah.
And you have the Cali sober, right? Which is you don't drink, but you smoke. And again, whatever makes you happy and feel like you have that lust for life to get out of bed every morning, I'm a fan of it.
Yeah.
Who am I to say what the right or wrong way to live is? And I get a lot of those calls too. Well, I'm just smoking herb, but I feel terrible and I know I'm not a heroin. And then like, it doesn't matter the desired choice that led you to get on the phone to call me. The end results are the same. The disconnection from reality, homicidal, suicidal, depressed, anxious, disconnect. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter the route that we took to.
What's your favorite tool to self-regulate when you feel like you're in a bad mood?
It depends on what created the bad mood. You know, a lot of times I wake up every day and some days, like I'm out here in California and I couldn't skate and I had created this whole itinerary, this list of things that were going to be done and accomplishments that will be made. And first day I'm wiped out. And since that every day, it's a struggle for me to come out of my hotel room. Right. Like I'll go down that rabbit hole really quick. And then I come out today and end up with my friends and we swim. And I had like a really peaceful meditative day and it was amazing. So ultimately what I know today is that I'm armed with the facts. I know that like I am the problem and I have it's no longer acceptable for me to sit in my problem. I know there's a solution. I have this heightened sense of awareness that people like you have taught me that ignorance is no longer bliss and I have to like do what's necessary in order to get myself out of my position. So if I'm out here, then I'll reach out to somebody that like is sober, that might be going to a meeting. I'll take a walk, just getting outside of my house, just getting some fresh air, getting the endorphins moving.
Yeah. Getting connected to life.
Something,
in some way,
form of connection.
Some outlet that you can plug into that gets you out of the state of mind of just
here,
sitting in
the
hotel
problem.
Room. Right.
The
right.
problem.
Get you moving a bit.
Yeah. And you know, the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
Right. So I know that, but it takes everything in me to put my clothes on, which isn't an elaborate event. It's some fucking workout pants and a t-shirt to go to the elevator, to go down to the lobby, to walk outside. That's like the equivalent to climbing Mount Everest mentally.
Right.
Because what I learned is my mentality will create my reality.
And that's why you say you got to take the action.
Literally.
And the thoughts follow.
Yeah.
I can't outthink
myself out of that room. But if I'm like, shut the fuck up. Boys do what they want to do. Men do what they have to do. Stop thinking. Do more. I just get up. I make myself. And before I know it, I'm outside. I'm like, wow, I feel better.
So what did you say? Boys do.
I love that. Yeah.
It went so quick.
That was good. say that one more time.
I get all excited. This gets me high.
You said.
Boys do what they want to do. Men do what they have to do. And that's, I say that to myself. I say these mantras to myself that help me on a daily basis like that. Rejection is God's protection. God doesn't do things to us, but for us. You know, I say that a lot, those two things.
Yeah, when I couldn't afford 1 year Christmas gifts. So I worked at this place called the Retreat Center. It was a 12-step based place in Minnesota. And I got everyone bookmarks where my face would be at the top smiling.
That's great.
And the it said, fear knocked, faith answered, there was no one there. And I love that quote. I just love thinking about it, how when there's fear and you apply faith that, literally, there's nothing there. It disappears. And recovery has so many cool sayings.
It does.
So many. It's like a pity party table for one. The ambulance will come right over. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
It's all those. And Dr. Phil says this. He says, what does he say? Not cliches. What are they called? All these things that we're talking about. These attacks.
I know.
mantras, taglines?
Quotes?
It's going to drive me crazy now. I won't think of it because I'm thinking of it.
Yeah. But he says they become that and they live over time.
Yeah.
Because they're so real.
Yeah. I mean, they save my life on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Because I'll allow myself to go insane.
So, Brandon, where can everyone find you?
The easiest way? Yeah, you could just go to my website, which is www.brandonnovak.com, all one word. And that will take you down the rabbit hole of all of my other things.
Cool. And in those other things, there's you've written two books.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really stoked on that. I wrote my first book, which was titled Dream Seller, that became like insanely successful. Recently revised in its 9th edition. And then the sequel to that, The Streets of Baltimore, came out a year ago. I also was blessed with the ability to create the first ever addiction graphic novel called The Chronicles of Brandon Novak, which is really cool. It's like a comic book,
right,
for people like us, and these insane stories that I tell, like that, you know, the cholo gangbanger outfit, yeah. Look, not that one, but things like that. And we have this awesome artist out of Germany who stories didn't place in the book, but I wasn't going to throw them away. So we created that.
That's cool. I'm going to get a copy.
Yeah, I'll send you all of my stuff.
I want one.
I came underprepared, man. You give me all this nice stuff and I come with just...
I got some ideas. We'll talk afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Because
you got a lot of cool stuff going on. And I appreciate you coming in and sitting down with us.
This has been amazing. This has been a great day and a great ending to a really cool day. So I thank you for having me. This is like really unexpected.
I now love you, man.
Same. Truly. Cool. We're friends forever.
Till next time, guys, keep it magical.
Love you. Thank you.
This has been a Stage 29 podcast production. The podcast is executive produced by Patty Ciano, Laferne Cusack, and Stephanie Kaysen. Our audio editors are Jackson Ruff and Jonathan DeMatti. Callie Kiltz is the social media producer. And a special thanks to the rest of our podcast crew, Rwani Horinage, William Cusack, Lisa Clark, Katie Brown, and Morgan Kaler.
The Always Evolving with Coach Mike Bear podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended as a replacement or substitution for any professional, medical, financial, legal, or other advice, diagnoses, or treatment. This podcast does not constitute the practice of medicine or any other professional service. The use of any information provided during this podcast is at the listener's own risk. For medical or other advice appropriate to your specific situation, please consult a physician or other trained professionals.